of UBC. 50 years is not a long time as the life of universities go. As a matter of fact, we have in this room today three of the four presidents of this university, immediate past president, Dr. Larry McKenzie, and I ask you if you would stand up, please, Larry. And as the Chancellor said, we are fortunate to have with us also today President Emeritus Dr. Klink. Dr. Klink, would you stand up? That is in part a measure of how the living span the history of this university. But although UBC is relatively young in years compared to many of the world's universities, there are a few universities that can claim to have grown to the stature of UBC in such a short span of time. We started, as your program says, with 379 students in 1915 on September the 30th. And there were 34 faculty at that time. We were in shacks. It's true, we're still in shacks. We have more shacks now than we had then. But we have made a great deal of progress, clearly. There were two faculties, Faculty of Arts and Science and the Faculty of Applied Science, and the calendar listed 94 courses. Today's calendar lists 12 faculties and a total of 2,400 courses. I must say that I'm afraid to look back at the original calendar and find out whether the same 94 courses are still listed in today's calendar. Well, that's a little facetious because the university's program, in fact, does change, and courses are removed as new courses are added. But the growth of knowledge itself and the expansion of the interests and the directions of movement of this university have resulted in the enormous breadth of offerings which we have today. Our university now, of course, is very big, and in many ways it's a better university. But as the Chancellor has pointed out so eloquently, something also has been lost, something of the wonderful intimacy when virtually every student and every faculty member knew each other on a personal basis. And that intimacy makes, in retrospect, for nostalgia, which all of those of the early days must feel today. And we're fortunate indeed to have 19 members of that original faculty present in this room and 27 of the original students from those beginning days. I wonder, would they stand up? Well, they're here to tell us something about what the university was like in those days, and certainly I know that we're here to look back to those days, and this isn't an occasion for you to hear any long address from me. It will certainly make us wistful in many ways for the quiet life to hear what Dr. Logan and Mr. David Brock have to say, Mr. Justice Lord. But we can't turn the clock back except in memory, and the university of today is the fact with which we live. I might just ask, though, what will it be like? I think it's hard for any of us to guess or imagine what the university will be like 50 years from today, as it would have been in those early days for the faculty or the students to imagine the University of British Columbia as it exists today. My personal guess is that the university will continue to grow enormously. I would not be surprised if I were able to come back 50 years from now to find that it was a campus of 50,000 students or more, and that buildings filled every inch of our 1,000 acres. I think maybe there will not, in those future days, be many more undergraduates than there are today. But surely there will be great graduate schools and institutes in professional schools serving this province and this nation. And I think the university will by that time be surrounded by a complex of highly sophisticated science-oriented industries in those endowment lands which have been on the fringe of this university since its beginning. I think those industries will be attracted here, as they will be attracted shortly, because they will be dependent on the skills and the consulting that are available from the universities. And that complex of industries, I suspect 50 years from now, will be the economic lifeblood and center of this province. Well, whether these guesses are right or wrong, only the future can tell. But we do know that the future will be different. And if some today are appalled at the thought of a campus of 50,000 students, can we be any more shocked than those students of 1915 and that faculty of 1915 would have been in trying to imagine and visualize the size and complexity of UBC of 1965. Well, so much for some casual remarks of mine. I would like to introduce to you Dr. Harry Logan, whom this university honored this year with a degree of Doctor of Laws. He has had the longest association with UBC of any faculty member. He was present at the convocation in 1912, which elected the first chancellor of the university. And when McGill University College, where he was a lecturer, was replaced by the University of British Columbia, he was appointed an instructor in classics in 1915. In the summer of that year, he helped a student committee to draft the constitution of the present Alma Mater Society. War service prevented his teaching at the university until 1920. But since that date, he has served in all ranks in the Department of Classics, which he headed for 3 years, and he is still carrying on as a special lecturer, loved and admired by students throughout this campus. While a member of the faculty, he sat for many years on the University Senate, and he has also been a member of the Board of Governors, an appointment made possible by his resignation from the university in the 30s to become principal of Prince of Wales Fairbridge College. He was the first colonel of the COTC when it was revived on this campus in 1928, and for several years he edited the Alumni Chronicle. It was entirely appropriate that when the university wished to publish the history of its first 50 years to MS, it turned to him to act as its author. No other professor of the Faculty of Arts has had a longer or more friendly association with students than as Harry Logan, and it is a great pleasure and privilege to call on him to address you. Harry. It's a wonderful occasion, Harry.
Madam Chancellor, Mr. President, fellow guests of the old buildings down in Fairview, and the friends who are here and former members of our great university. I do salute also the younger generation in certain numbers in the gallery. I must say that I've been greatly moved by the Chancellor's picture of what the Fairview conditions were in the old days. She has pictured there a rosier painting, a rosier color, than I think perhaps many of those of us who were there saw in the situation that was there. Well, for two or three years, I was engaged in writing the history, story, I like to call it rather than a history, of UBC from those old days. And I found it extremely difficult when I was doing the writing of that part of our story to stop writing about it and get on with the story of the later years of BC. It seems a long time, that 50 years, as one goes through it. And I don't propose at this moment to delay you on recounting that long story which can be read elsewhere and much of which is familiar to a great many people in Brock Hall today. As I have cast my mind back over the years to the event that we are commemorating today, two or three factors stand out above others. First, and more significant perhaps than any other, is the fact reiterated frequently by our first president, Dr. Westbrook, that the university was born in a time of tragedy. The First World War was more than 1 year old, and its effects had already set the stage for UBC. The struggle of the president and his board to move to Point Grey had failed. Dr. Westbrook was for 2.5 years in Vancouver with his headquarters and working away with certain members of faculty that he had appointed, and in particular Dean Klink, who of course later became our president and remained so for some 25 years, and whom we're delighted to see here today, and who was, in those 2.5 years, Dr. Westbrook's right hand in studying and preparing the way for our university that was to be. Well, the attempts of the president and the board to move the university out to Point Grey failed, and the work had to be carried on in the buildings at Fairview. This story is, of course, familiar. What is less familiar, except to faculty and students of those days, is the deep and lasting impression made by war conditions on the life of our university. In looking back to 1919, over the 4 years passed at UBC, the editor of the 1919 annual, which of course was the first name of what is now the Totem, wrote these words: "The work of all classes in these years was much disorganized, and everyone felt a little out of poise." I would suggest that's a very great understatement. But it has been highly pleasing to see the mutual feeling between the faculty and student body in attempting to regain what was lost and to make the present count for the most. You know, that's a student who was writing. The university was affected, one may say, deeply by the war. The numbers of men students diminished. Already on registration in September, 56 men students were overseas. The total registration, as you see in the document that's been given to you, the total registration was 379. Almost one half of the art students were women. In the 3 years of the war, 697 students enlisted. That is, the 3 years after UBC had opened its doors. 697 students enlisted, and 78 laid down their lives. Student organizations, which included military training and Red Cross work, were carried on with enthusiasm within the university, by men and by the students and by members of faculty. But always, the work of students in their undergraduate affairs, which were carried on with enthusiasm, had an underlying sense of seriousness. Faculty and students were brought together, as our Chancellor has said, in close association. The actual opening of lectures was more of the nature of a transition from McGill College to UBC. The arts faculty added a freshman class, to the 3 years that were handed over by McGill College, and applied science added a first year to the two classes supplied by McGill. McGill College faculty in Vancouver, with Professor Wood and Professor Howard Russell from Victoria College, constituted the main body of the UBC faculty of 34. Under the presidency of Dr. Westbrook, administrative heads were Dean L.S. Klink, who was Dean of Agriculture, who became our president, of course, later, and Dean R.W. Brock of the Faculty of Applied Science. Professor George Robinson, who was the Dean of McGill College in Vancouver, was later appointed the Dean of Arts. UBC was therefore fortunate in the legacy that came from McGill College. The great majority of her students and faculty came from that source. The buildings, such as they were, came from McGill College. A money gift came also from the Royal Institution, which reminds us of this early association. We have today still 3 annual scholarships: the Royal Institution Scholarship, the McGill Graduate Scholarship, and the J.C. Shaw Scholarship, which are the result of gifts from the Royal Institution of McGill College in British Columbia. The spirit which animated UBC at its beginnings is nowhere better expressed than in the words of Dr. Westbrook that appeared in the UBC annual published by the first graduating class in 1916. Here are his words. "We, the present student body, staff, Senate, Board of Governors, and members of convocation of this infant university, may well be envied by those who have gone before and by those who will come after us. To us has come the opportunity of making our province, our dominion, our empire, and our world a better place in which to live. May our sympathies be so widened and our service so extended to all the people of the province that we may indeed be the People's University whose motto is Tuum Est." That is the spirit on which this university was founded, and in my opinion, it still lives and survives and is still active on this great campus in these days of affluence today. Thank you. I've been asked to invite all retired faculty who were in the Fairview Shacks to stand and to remain standing. And also, all other retired UBC faculty, will they please stand? Thank you. It's now my very happy duty to introduce one of the men who entered UBC on that first day of lectures as a freshman. He joined the university along with many other members of a student body who matriculated directly from high school and entered UBC without having experienced the civilizing influences of McGill College. Its songs, its slogans, its yells, that dying practice, the practice which died some 20 years ago, but which used to thrill every member of our student body and a few members of faculty, I think, when they were given in public places by all our students. As a freshman, he was elected president of men's athletics and a member of the first students' council, of which Sherwood Lett was the first president. I think probably that constitutes a record of being elected, the freshman being elected president of men's athletics and a member of the students' council. He enlisted for overseas service at the end of the session. He was severely wounded in battle in 1917 and returned to UBC to graduate with the class of 1921. In his third year, he was again elected president of men's athletics and captain of the senior rugby team. He had the distinction of being coach of the famous rugby squad that defeated Stanford in December 1920 in a game that any of us who saw will never forget. As a senior, he was elected president of the Alma Mater Society, and he was president of the Alumni Society in 1925. He won a high reputation as a member of the Players Club during his undergraduate days after World War I. Few of our graduates, surely, have given more freely in devoted service to our alma mater. He served on the University Senate for 38 years and for 18 years on the Board of Governors. His service to British Columbia and to Canada has been continuous from his undergraduate days. Mr. Justice Arthur Lord, Justice of the Court of Appeal.
Madam Chancellor, Mr. President, honored guests and ladies and gentlemen, little did I ever dream when I attended the first class of the university in the fall of 1915 that 50 years later I would be attending a gathering of this kind in circumstances quite different, of course, and amongst such in the middle of such a number of buildings that we have out here, as compared with what we had when we only had those less than 400 students. I'll never forget the first meeting also of the student body and the faculty. The auditorium that we had at that time was on the second floor of what we called the Arts Building and had been erected as a TB building for the hospital. The library eventually was down on the main floor, some of you with a memory will remember, and the auditorium was on the second floor. Well, when the first meeting had been called, I was deputized to see that all those in the halls got into the auditorium at the right and proper time before President Westbrook started the proceedings. I've told this story quite often about a particular member of the faculty. I noticed just before the meeting was to start, one young man wandering around in a dazed sort of way, looked as though he was wondering where he should be. So I went and grabbed him by the arm and I said, "Here, the meeting's just getting started. Get in there." I found out later, some week or so later, that that was Professor Freddie Wood. So you can see, even Freddie looks quite youthful, even yet. Harry Logan has said that he doesn't quite agree with the rosy picture which the Chancellor has painted of the early days, and said that he didn't think that it's quite as rosy as she would indicate. But I think everything was rosy in those days. And I think that, of course, I speak from the position of a student, not of a professor who had possibly more in the way of responsibilities than a student had. But those early days of the university were wonderful. Students, you know, have different ways of expressing themselves when they don't agree on certain things that should be happening around the university, or which did happen and should not have happened. As an instance of the way it was handled on one occasion at the university just after the war, a great deal of feeling around amongst a great many people that war was ended, and it was a war to end wars, so why have anything more to do with matters military? But the COTC kept on going under Harry Letson. On one occasion, one of those who possibly thought that COTC had been running long enough got on top of what I have described as the arts building, and he found a fire hose up there. COTC was parading just down below. He turned the fire hose on, and the COTC scattered a bit. Well, the culprit was caught. I don't know whether he's here today or not. Jack Weld here? That was the first day of the student court. We had a student court to try Jack. And I remember Gordon Scott, I think I saw Gordon coming in here tonight, this afternoon somewhere. Gordon, you here? Gordon Scott came in. However, I remember him being on that student court, and there was another one, a lawyer, a man who eventually went in for law, Hosang, and he was a Chinese, very intelligent chap. He won the oratorical contest, too. We used to have those horrible things called oratorical contests, but he was a winner of that. It was a wonderful trial which lasted 2 days, and the way the criminal code was flashed around was something I haven't seen since. As I say, the comparison of the way students are doing things, I don't suppose there is any difference in the way students handle things today. They're objecting very strenuously to this increase in fees. And they're even going so far as to suggest that fees should be wiped out altogether. But I'm one of those who believe that if a person is going in for a higher education, he ought to pay for some of it at any rate. But their form of protest seems to me to be, don't pay your fees. That's cutting off your nose to spite your face, I think. What's going to happen if you don't pay your fees? Is the university going to close down because they won't have your money? Won't be able to pay the faculty? So I think they'd better take a second look at that. And I know the student ingenuity can bring up something better than that. Because all they want to do is to point up what they think is an injustice and let them do it in another way than that. That's my own personal opinion. Now, my time is limited. I was given 5 minutes. I think I've gone a bit beyond that. I would like, I was handed this note here before coming in. Will all those who were students in 1915 please stand and remain standing, please? We'd like to have a look. Will you remain standing, please? Will all those who were students in the Fairview Shacks, not only in 1915, but at any time we were at Fairview Shacks, will you stand, please? Thank you. Thank you. No, I think that's a very, very good turnout for having a 50-year period go by. And I'm sure you'll all agree with me that the days that we had with such a small student body and our faculty, where everybody became friends, we all knew each other. So many of the professors at the back of the stage here became my personal friends in those days and remain so ever since. And I think it's a great privilege to have been there during those years. Now, the last thing on this program which was handed to me was call for a Kitsilano. Now, I wonder, being who I am, see, there's this suggestion here has been made that I am the author of that yell. Well, I was, along with Joe Johansson. I remember in one of the classrooms of this arts building, using a blackboard there for a day or so, until we finally got this yell perfected, in such form at any rate as could be given. The idea of it was, you see, to cheer up the home team and to curdle the blood of the opposing teams when it was given. The words do not mean very much, except that it's the old phrase comes from that and used to be used around the university so frequently. It was klahau yatilikum, just a form of greeting. Now, I don't know. I really shouldn't do this because of supposed to uphold dignity, I suppose. But probably I'd better repeat it to you because some of you have probably forgotten it. Goes this way: Kitsilano, Capilano, Siwash, Squaw, Klahauya, Tilikum, Skookum, Wa, Hi, You, Mamuk, Mucka, Mucka, Zip, BC, Varsity, Rip, 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 VARSITY, Varsity. All right, now let's do it.
Thank you very much, Art, and boys and girls. David Brock also has a long connection with this university. His father, R.W. Brock, was the first dean of applied science, and Brock Hall is, of course, named in honor of his father and mother. He himself graduated from UBC in arts. By his writings and broadcasts, he's earned a reputation as a satirist and commentator in the contemporary scene. And that reputation, of course, extends far beyond the confines of this province. Mr. Brock has never lost his affection for his alma mater and has always been willing to return to its campus to speak with gentle and perceptive irony upon the foibles of the university community. We welcome the return of the native, Mr. Brock.